Record. Call the Senate Community Regional Affairs Committee to order. It is 1:35 p.m. Senators Donnelly, Hoffman, Phillips, and Mackey are present. Today we're going to hear three bills in the following order. First, Senate Bill 28, unincorporated municipal matching grants. Then Senate Bill 190 and Senate Bill 191 dealing with land issues. First of all, Senator Torgerson's here, the sponsor of Senate Bill 28. We'll take that up now. Senator, if you want to join us. Just for the committee's information, you have a CS in your packet for this particular bill. The CS was a result of Senator Torgerson and I working on this for quite some time to address the issues. It's substantially different than the original bill, so we're not going to do comparisons on the changes because there are several. Senator Torgerson is going to just present the CS as a new bill, and then we can deal with that way.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The thrust behind this bill was to let unincorporated communities that are in organized boroughs also participate in the unincorporated community matching grant program. Currently, under existing law, that grant money is only available if you're outside a borough. So that's the object of this bill. So the wording and how we finessed around it is how to achieve that. The unincorporated communities in an organized area, this sets up that they must match this money similar to how the boroughs do for their capital matching grant program, which most all boroughs are at 30%. So the unincorporated community must also come up with the initial 30% for the match. This does not change the existing unincorporated outside the boroughs from the 5% level that it's currently at. This changes the program so that you must have a project in order to be granted the money. Currently, you're given the money irregardless of if you have a project on the books or not. It was truly money looking for a project instead of the other way around, which is what most of our grant programs are, and that is money looking, or it was money looking for a project. We want to have a project looking for funding. This revises the fund distribution so projects can be based on health and safety considerations, subject to the ranking system put together by the department. We don't get into actually how that ranking is put together, but it's our thoughts it would be something similar to the DEC for water projects and other ranking criteria that's used across the board in other departments, and in some cases by this by CRA. Requires the governor to include projects in his capital budget with the, of course, it would come to the legislature for final appropriation to those projects, similar to what is happening now. And it changes the lapse time from the program from 5 years to 4 years. And basically what that's saying is that you can have a project approved and accumulate money for up to 4 years for the same project, since it does the maximum that can be granted in any one fiscal year is $25,000. So if you had a relatively large project or a $100,000 project, you wouldn't have to subsequently come back. You get that approved you'd be able to accumulate it for 4 years. Mr. Chairman, that's really the thrust of the bill. I think you have in your packet a list of incorporated areas by Senate District and the ones that are currently in the program by Senate District and the ones that would be added. It is roughly doubles the amount unincorporated. There, by the last numbers I saw, that it's somewhere around 70 that are unincorporated outside the boroughs, and there's somewhere around 70 that are unincorporated inside the borough. So it roughly doubles the amount of granting entities that could be in this program.
So, Senator Torgerson, in terms of the projects that are submitted to the legislature, then the governor and the agency would submit in the same form that they do they currently do now the number of projects that they would like the legislature to fund. Could you talk about what happens if the legislature were to fund a certain amount which was below the amount of communities that had requested the $25,000?
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's where we hope the ranking system will kick in and they'll projects will be ranked back to the life, health, safety type considerations, so that the department then would have some sort of mechanism that they could fund them based upon those criteria. And one other thing, Mr. Chairman, I just happened to remember that we're saying that the unincorporated areas inside of boroughs must have borough assembly approval for their project, and the borough assemblies must recognize the nonprofit entity that's going to represent that area, so we don't have a bunch of people or communities, unincorporated communities, applying for the grant program.
So if there are several different nonprofit entities that want to compete for a grant, then they must first go to their assembly and have the one designated to receive.
Yes, sir. Yes, that's correct. And the assembly must approve the project. So it does put a little system in there that the department and the governor's office won't be inundated with requests that haven't went through their appropriate local governing body.
Senator Hoffman.
This seems to, on the face, treat all the unincorporated communities much more fair, but on page 2, another major change that you have is that in section 2, you're changing the amount of the grant from a maximum of $25,000 to a minimum of $25,000, and I think everyone is well aware that it's, even though you years from 5 to 4, so a community can accumulate up to $100,000 for a construction project, but many projects are a lot larger, you know, in many rural areas in the
right
state.
It's
conceivable that you can't even build a 40 by 60 building for $100,000.
Well,
so what my question is, why are we say, you know, I know the legislature or the governor in his budget requests he has not requested more than that, but who knows, times may change and price of oil may go up to $40 a barrel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Hoffman, you know, there are other processes to go through to receive grant money besides this one. This was never to be everything for an unincorporated community to pick projects without having some kind of fiscal restraint on it and just come in and just start asking for it at $25,000 a year and have it be reoccurring. You know, I think that it was a policy call on my part, or not a policy call, but I just thought 5 years was too long to accumulate it. I really don't have a heartburn if it went to 5 years from the 4 years, but like I said, it's just a policy call to chop it off there instead of the 5 years. To change the minimum from maximum is basically allows, with the word minimum in there, if I had a $7,000 project, I'd have got $25,000 for it. And that's not right either. There are projects out there that are a lot smaller. Remember, this is given to the communities and held in an account for them if they have a project or not. That's why it was minimum. It was totally a giveaway program in some degree, until they found a project to spend it on. And none of our capital programs are intended to do that. So this kind of, like you said, levels the playing field, but it also, by going to the maximum, we could probably squeeze more communities in if they had smaller requests to begin with. And hopefully not all of them are going to come in for some futuristic thing that is $100,000 and it all ends up being some type of accumulation account until they reach that $100,000.
So that with a minimum of $25,000, a community comes in, say, with a project of $75,000, and he's ranked at the top of the list, then that community does not have to apply again and will automatically get the $25,000 until they get their cumulative of $75,000 for the construction of that project?
That's my understanding, yes.
That's the intent.
Currently, they get that for 5 years without a project. So we're saying if you have an approved project, you can accumulate up to 4 years.
Also, just to comment on that, I also concurred with Senator Torgerson on that particular area. Number one, we are adding more communities to the program. 4 years at $25,000 was a nice round number at $100,000. I think the concept was, first of all, to have a ceiling and also have a cumulative ceiling in order to hopefully be able to get more projects over the long run and more communities involved in the program and getting some of the smaller projects taken care of. And I'm hopeful that it will accomplish that as well. Senator Phillips?
John, I don't know whether you thought about this or not, but page 2, line 2, I was looking for a definition of a social unit. I really do think we probably should define what that means. I see some problems, somebody trying to manipulate that in the future.
Well, you caught me on that one. I've assumed that would be the same as a community, but we don't really define a community either. So we have both of them in there. They must meet, the community was in place in the state and has 25 more individuals.
Senator, perhaps since yourself as well as the two members here that are on the Finance Committee, maybe we could get a comment from the drafter as to why that particular terminology was used and have that information available at the next stop.
I'd be glad to do that. I didn't
that's
identify.
A good point. Sure, that's a good point.
Yeah, that is a good point.
We might need to further define that.
Well, and I think, Mr. Chairman, some of that is because, well, I was going to say that we do have other grantees besides unincorporated communities that are registered as unincorporated communities in here. So the maybe that's why that says is a social unit. I'm not sure.
Senator, I had one other question. Before we take action on the CS, this bill obviously has a history in dealing with the actual entities and so forth in some of the unorganized areas that could qualify. It's not your intention to deal with any of those other than what we have in the bill?
As far as the ones, the Native communities that we wavered in, is that what you're referring to? No. As I mentioned to you, but I'll be glad to share it with the committee, I think that decision is far more broad-based than originally was because of the Venati lawsuit. That's all going to be settled outside of what this body's going to do. So initially, I did have it in there that you had to be a recognized nonprofit within the state of Alaska to receive this money, which meant anybody claiming sovereignty would, of course, are not nonprofits organized in Alaska. They're organized under federal law or some other law anyway. But it's not my intent to amend that. It actually quite the opposite. It was in there, and I amended it out in the sponsor substitute that right at the end of the session. And I think that was what I was referring to about the social unit, because I think that's what, I don't want to speak for the drafters, but I think that's probably why they put social unit in there, because some entities aren't communities as defined by an unincorporated community and filed under the state of Alaska as a recognized unincorporated. So,
okay.
I think that's probably what they'll tell us.
Just one other thing I'd like to ask you to comment on. I guess an argument could be made justifiably that an unorganized community such as Nanilchik, for example, which is in your district, versus a unincorporated community in the unorganized borough, that there's really not much difference in the needs of those two communities to be able to participate in a program like this. And I think that adds to the reason for wanting to level the playing field. Can you comment just briefly on what Nanilchik's problem has been in terms of being able to do a project like an ambulance or something else which would further add to the necessity for doing this? What's their relationship with the boroughs a lot of times when they're caught up in a big bureaucracy?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I can only assume that some things, but I think one of the assumptions was when the boroughs were created is they would be sort of a granting agent and exercise more powers in reflection to unincorporated communities, supplying grant money or other things to these unincorporated. That hasn't happened in any borough. The only money they get might be granting money directly to the borough for that particular purpose, but not an absolute set-aside program like this is. The Nilchik's particular problem was they did have an ambulance that they were trying to buy. They are not a service area. They're a volunteer fire department. Their services are mainly to, a lot of cases, people coming down fishing in the summertime. Their community swells from about 600 to about 6,000, I suppose, or maybe even bigger than that during couple of months of the year, and they had requested through all channels to try to get a money for an ambulance. I actually had it in the budget that passed the 19th legislature and was vetoed by the governor. So after that veto, I went to look for programs that they might be able to fit into, and that's actually where this one came out. That's really where the 4 years came from in my mind, because if they would have accumulated $25,000 for 4 years and had that guarantee, then they could have went ahead and purchased the ambulance. And with their local match of $30,000 in this case, or the 30%, we're still requiring the area to pony up more than some other areas of the state, and maybe that'll be covered through the efforts of the borough assemblies.
Any other questions from the committee? Okay, thank you, Senator. Do we have anybody here in the public that would like to testify on this bill? Anybody from the department, DCRA?
We're here basically to answer questions, Mr. Chair.
Can you come forward?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kim Metcalf-Helmar. I'm a special assistant from Community and Regional Affairs. We just got a copy of the committee substitute when we came here. Unfortunately, we haven't had a lot of chance to look it over. But the one thing that does stand out is the establishment of a ranking system. I think that would change program administration significantly. And I think we'd like to have a chance to look that over for additional fiscal impacts to the department. Other than that, Tina Young is here. She runs the program now, and she's available for questions.
Okay, I just wanted to provide any opportunity to the department. If you have any comments, I recognize the CS. We got the CS this morning at about 10:30 from the drafters, and the senator and I needed to review that prior to the meeting. So we'll look forward to it. Is my intention to want to move this bill today, and we'll look forward to your input, the department's input to the senator and to the finance committee. It's next stop.
Thank you.
Anyone else here to testify on the bill? With that, Senator Phillips.
My motion?
Sure. I'd like to move the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move Senate Bill 28 as a committee substitute.
Right.
And move it on to the next committee referral, individual recs, and that committee, the next committee would be finance.
Okay. For the record, the motion is to adopt the committee substitute and move it to the next committee. Any objection? Hearing none, the bill is moved. Thank you, Senator. Yeah, go ahead. Okay, first of all, the next bill we'll hear is Senate Bill 190, which, Dave, can I have you present this bill? Okay. Committee will stand at ease. Recess for a couple minutes. Meeting come back to order. We're back on record. At this time, as the next two bills are legislation sponsored by myself, I'd like to ask Senator Phillips to chair this portion of the meeting, and I'll relinquish the chair at this time to him so I can present these to the committee. Senate Bill 190, Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I introduced Senate Bill 190 to bring fairness and expediency to state municipal government actions which require the acquisition of private land for public uses. The usual practice is to acquire private property through condemnation proceedings. This is a process where the governmental entity exercises the power of eminent domain to take the property and compensate the owner with or without the private owner's consent or agreement. The only recourse for an unwilling owner is to challenge in court the validity of the takings, public purpose, and the amount of compensation. In most cases, the court's consideration is principally to determine the appropriate level of compensation. For both the governmental entity and the private property owner, this can be an expensive and time-consuming procedure. For many landowners, the prospect of contesting a condemnation proceeding in court is often beyond the landowner's financial abilities to pursue. In these situations, the landowner is at the mercy of the governmental entity, the extent of its property desires, and its method of determining compensation. SB 190 would simply require that prior to condemnation, a reasonable and diligent effort is made to purchase private property through negotiations with the property owner. At least 23 states have similar requirements. So I guess in a nutshell, right now, should the state or municipal government or whoever want to come in and condemn private property, the only recourse for someone is to challenge them in court. And I think it's reasonable to ask that that the government entity that's going to take the land makes every diligent effort to negotiate with the person on a price and a value and so forth prior to just taking it. I think the situation could occur and does occur that perhaps someone that doesn't have any money or an understanding of the legal process could be overwhelmed with the bureaucracy and really be at a disadvantage in trying to protect his or her property rights. So that's the general purpose for this piece of legislation, and you know, that's the reason it's here before us. I'll check this sign-up
sheet. I got it here.
Yeah, you got it.
For the record, that was Chairman Mackin testifying on his bill, Senate Bill 190. Does that conclude your remarks?
For now, yes, unless there are any questions.
Any questions? Okay. Anything else?
No.
On your part? Okay, the next person we have is Rick Harris. Okay, and at this point in time, I'll turn the gavel over to Chairman Mackin.
Thank you, Senator Phillips. Good afternoon, Rick. If we could ask you to state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Oh, thank you, Senator. My name is Rick Harris. I'm here to speak before you on Senate Bill 190, Eminent Domain. I have copies of my testimony here, which I can pass out.
Dave, let me grab this.
My name is Richard Harris. I'm the vice president of Sea Alaska Corporation. We're a native corporation organized under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. We have 330,000 acres of fee estate scattered throughout southeast Alaska. Eminent domain has become an important issue to us, not because we're an ANSCA corporation, but because we're a private landholder within the state, not just ANSCA land, but other land. And what we find is that the eminent domain bill, that the laws that are currently before us, do not provide the protections that we would like to have in our dealings with the government. Senate Bill 190 would add some additional protections to the private landowner. And what it would require is that the state or the condemning party diligently attempt to purchase private property before taking it through eminent domain. Alaska, as you know, values the importance of private property and their property rights, and we believe that the government should not intrude on those rights except gingerly and only as a last resort. Unfortunately, the laws do not reflect Alaska's respect for private land, nor Alaska's lack of private land. We believe that there are two prerequisites that would be critical to any eminent domain, to improve the eminent domain law, and that is to require a diligent, good faith effort to purchase, and then also to justify the particular property interest that is being taken. Senator Mackey represented, there are over 23 states that have similar types of protections. With respect to the good faith effort to purchase, right now we find ourselves in a situation of not being an arm's length transaction with the condemning body. They are able to step forward, and because they know they have the power of condemnation, there really is no real diligent need for them to sit down and negotiate at an arm's length basis. We think that SB 190 helps level the playing field and improves that arm's length relationship. This is not unreasonable. The eminent domain code states that the purpose of preliminary purchase attempts include the protecting of private property owners from arbitrary and unexpected exercises of eminent domain power, facilitating an amicable settlement of disputes so as to the amount of just compensation, minimizing acquisition costs through reduction of litigation, and promotion of citizen cooperation. So what we're asking for here is already recognized in the Uniform Eminent Domain Code. So another point we'd like to bring, and that is that the specific property to be taken. Frequently, we see condemnation occurring on a fee basis where some other type of condemnation could occur, that be it through rights of way or easements. And so we think that the government or the condemning body should again be able to prove what interest they need to have before they can condemn the property. That, Senator, really represents the conclusion of our comments. In my comments, we have a little bit more of a summary of what the bill does. We'll be prepared to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Harris. Senator Phillips.
I guess, why is this a problem? I mean, can you give me an example of this? Because I've been involved with a few of these situations in my own district, and it worked out fairly well.
Senator, we've had several situations where we've had the eminent domain used against us. We haven't been particularly satisfied with the result.
I'll give you an example.
Cake Airport is an example. In this case, the Department of Transportation came forward, said that we want to expand the airport. We're prepared to condemn the property. We're prepared to compensate you. But we really found ourselves in a very uncomfortable situation. In this case, we owned the trees, and all they wanted to do was purchase the right-of-way. So what they did is they required that we cut down the trees. We can never grow the trees back to commercial height again. They have to be retained at this low level. So we effectively have a piece of property out there that is unable to any longer be commercial forest land. And so we have these kinds of experiences throughout our region.
Hard time grasping that. But go ahead.
Senator Donnelly.
Good day. Well, you guys got the benefit from the airport, didn't you?
Yes, that's what... Well, let's have a philosophical discussion here first.
Rick, could you describe the municipal airport or the state airport and how that works?
At Cake, as an example? In this circumstance, the approach to the airport is commercial forest land.
Right.
It is growing trees. And what we have had is, in this case, they came and said, we are going to, by eminent domain, take this property. We did enter into a negotiating process.
For the purpose of safety?
It was for the purpose of safety on the approach. So effectively what happened is they said, okay, we are now going to take this property, and what we're getting in this case is the air rights, and when we do that, we are going to not allow you to grow trees up into the airspace again. So what is happening is our trees are then becoming a safety problem. And what we felt was that they were not allowing us to use the land for what we believe it should be used for, which is commercial forest land. And instead, now we have a piece of ground that we really can't grow Christmas trees on even. So what we're trying to do is to say that we need to have a better negotiating process in terms of how the state comes to us to negotiate the using their eminent domain authorities.
Senator Donnelly?
But if you've got a legitimate claim and the state's not negotiating with you, you can go to court.
Right. And the situation that we find, and I think Representative Mackey touched on that to some degree, is that what we find is that the cost of litigation becomes just as difficult as the negotiation. In fact, and I didn't mention that in my testimony, but there were suggestions that perhaps the bill that we have before should be strengthened further by requiring that when the state or the condemning body makes a declaration of eminent domain, that they have to pay that amount of money. We can receive the money and then use that money as a vehicle to litigate. So this not only represents us, but also small landowners throughout the state. And that the issue was brought before us is that the eminent domain is really a situation that small landowners as well find themselves in a hostile situation of having these proceedings brought against them, not reaching an amicable solution, but having no money or literally exhausting their resources and reserves in order to appeal this issue.
That particular section is not before us at this time, and I've asked Senator Taylor is going to review that when it's in judiciary to deal with that particular one. But I don't know if the airport is the best example. Mm-hmm. To use in this particular case. I mean, let's take a private citizen that's going to have their land taken from them, and albeit for a good cause, whether it be an airport or for whatever reason that the public feels is an important reason to take it, that's not the objection. The objection is that they just basically get served with a notice. This is your deal, and this is how it's going to be. versus trying to work through the options with them and try to make a diligent effort. I mean, nothing in the legislation says that they have to come to any one particular conclusion. It's just to provide that opportunity. Otherwise, the only recourse for that person is to go to court and to sue and litigate the issue. And a lot of times that's pretty frightening to an ordinary citizen. Senator Hoffman?
A better example that would be more prevalent would be widening a road that affects many landowners.
I already know about those.
You know, I think that it would make sense for the state to make a good faith effort.
Let me, about 10 years ago, we had the development of the Highland Bridge project, about a $28 million project. 44 homes were in the way. And we went through this whole process, and we got with every single homeowner there, and they were well compensated for it. And I'm trying to figure out, you know, that's just one experience I had with it, and I'm trying to figure out where's the problem that you guys are having that, you know, I don't, I mean, it was pretty emotional for 44 homeowners. They said, we're going to move your house because we need this bridge, and you're in the way. And, you know, we had our community meeting. We met with the DOT and da-da-da-da-da, and they were later on well compensated for the literally destroying their homes. And I'm trying to figure out, why is it so different for you guys in this process? And that's what I'm trying to pinpoint, where in the process that is really a sticky point for you.
Well, I think, Senator, probably in your circumstance, and we have seen this process work before, and in some cases we have been satisfied and we think that the process works fine. In other cases, we have found a situation that they basically come in and say, here's the deal. It's not really open for negotiation, subject for negotiation. This is it. If you don't do it, we're just going to move straight to condemnation. And we have people literally sitting in our office saying, this is it. No more. We're moving to condemnation. And so in those situations, what we're trying to do is to say, wait a minute, we have to have a level playing field. Because if you don't want to negotiate, when you have 44 homeowners and a senator, then it, of course, is very interested in it. Where you have one party or one entity, it's a little bit different circumstance. You can work from a little bit different position. And what we've done is we've had some uncomfortable situations that we have had to work our way through this system. And we felt that we were not on a level playing field. And what we're trying to do is to say that, wait a minute, we should have a right as well to develop our own appraisals, to develop our own systems and our own valuations. And they basically are saying, no, these are, we're going to do it this way. Here's our value. This is the way it will be done.
Senator Donnelly?
But you do have a right to do all that. If they go to a condemnation procedure, all you got to do is respond, show up in court, make your case, right?
And I think what we're trying to do, Senator, is avoid going to court. That's a very important part of, and as I read to you the quote from the Uniform Eminent Domain Code, that's very important because the idea is to try to move these things to amicable solutions and not to carry these forward into litigation. You're right, we can take it to court. In some cases, you just simply cut your losses at that point.
No, I'm not. You don't have to take it to court. You're a respondent. They're the ones taking you to court.
But you still have to defend yourself. You still have to be able to build a case that their values, their numbers are wrong. And so I think what we're saying is
you'd have to do that anyway in these negotiations. Yeah.
Right, but the negotiations are done not in a court situation. We're not avoiding the legal hassles of lawyers and everything else. At that point, we're on an equal plane with a condemning body and are able then to step forward and develop, and as I say, start with a fair playing field in order to negotiate what should be the proper compensation. And your example is an excellent one, Senator.
Senator Phillips?
Maybe it's kind of our situation in Anchorage. I don't know what it is. I'm trying to figure out, why is this so different? Okay,
well, I mean, our experience, it's very difficult to get anything done in Anchorage. Yeah. You can't build a road. I mean, it takes years and years to get everybody to agree along the way to get it done the way it is now. And people get fully compensated, but we've got real difficulties getting from point A to point B because we can't acquire the land necessary to get there.
And
it just looks like, I don't know, and frankly, I don't know what a judge is going to believe that reasonable and due diligence and diligent effort means. I mean, what's different about diligent than reasonable? What's different about reasonable than diligent? I'm kind of confused about that language here. I think it's kind of in the eye of the beholder, and knowing our judiciary, it could radically be different from jurisdiction to jurisdiction as which judge looked at this and what their mood was that particular day.
Senator Phillips. Yeah. I guess the point I would make is, you know, there's lots of different examples that could be used. Sea Alaska Corporation or any other large private landowner, in most cases, would always have the resources to be able to do what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. But let's not forget about the little old person out there that doesn't have any money, or they don't have a bunch of lawyers, or they don't have a bunch of resources to go out and challenge the government who wants to take away their house. And I guess the question is, you know, what is unreasonable about asking the government to make a reasonable effort to negotiate with the person prior to taking their land? It doesn't conclude that any one result has to occur or anything else, and it's actually a very small change in the law to provide that reasonable opportunity. Right now, it's take it or leave it. In your case, Senator, where it worked out fine with the community and hearings and everything, fine, that's not a problem. But there are other cases where they don't have the luxury of having opportunity.
What I'm trying to say, I'm trying to figure out, you got the case, you probably have a few other examples mm-hmm. you should bring out, but we have a system right now, everybody's buying by the same rules, right? And I'm trying to figure out, why is this so different? Is it because of an attitude from DOT? I assume you were dealing with guys here in Juneau versus the northern region or mm-hmm. central region, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they're all operating on the same rules, northern region, central region, and southeast. They had taken 44 homes away and mm-hmm. literally plucked them out of the ground and said, you're gone. And they worked with those people individually, and I'm trying to figure out why is this situation so different than the situation that I went through here about 10 years ago, working with DOT, the homeowners, the community council, mm-hmm. And so on and so forth.
I think, Senator, our experience has been that it's been a frustrating one and not fulfilling and certainly not amicable. It's basically the threat is, the gun is pretty much put to our head and said, this is going to happen. And we have contested really two basic things is, why do you need to take this? Why do you need to take this particular interest? And why can't you take a lesser interest? In some circumstances, and in the other cases, we have not been satisfied with the result, but recognizing that we were probably going to be paying more for lawyers than we were going to get out of the settlement. And so we found ourselves in being in a rather uncomfortable position. Now, I think, and in our comments, and I skipped over it in the conclusion, but you know, we don't believe that SB 190 in the term that you have described would in any way affect the process that you went through. In fact, we're just simply saying that the process you went through was a fair one. It was one that took a while.
But
it took some time.
That's not because of the law. It's because of how it was handled.
Right. And what we're saying is, let's see if we can't help the law be a little clearer in terms of the fairness of the negotiation and also in the fairness of the interest that would be taken. You don't always have to take the interest in fee simple, for example. It could be some other interest, such as easements or other types of rights.
Well, there's also, the other thing is, we're going to be passing, if we pass this thing as a state law, we have some problems in the area that, like Tudor and
Lake Otis. East 68th was tied up for 5 years because one guy didn't want a sidewalk.
Right. Jewel Lake, Four Corners.
So the school kids couldn't get to school for like 4 years, the new school. They had no way to safely get to school because one property owner wouldn't go along with it.
And then you got the same problem with Four Corners at Jewel Lake a few years ago. The same situation.
Well, my question would be, where would the language that's changed here
I'm trying to figure out whether this is a matter of law or a matter of approaches by the department or DOT. I assume most of it's DOT, or is it all of it DOT?
It's been mostly DOT, yes.
All right. So it sounds like we got an attitude problem.
Well,
that's what it looks like to me.
Sure. If all the circumstances turned out the way that in your area that it turned out, great. There wouldn't even be any need for this. But as if, there is outside of Anchorage, other circumstances that exist in other regions of the state and different personnel you're dealing with and perhaps even different attitudes. I don't look at this as a way to change someone's attitude or anything else. I look at this as a way to protect an individual's right to at least have the government try to negotiate with them in good faith. If that doesn't happen, if they're being stubborn or if they're being like the circumstance that Senator Donnelly brought up, then, of course, the statute doesn't change as to how the state can go in and condemn it. All we're saying is they ought to make a good faith effort to negotiate with the person rather than just come in and say, we're taking your land. And I think that's reasonable.
You just said it. You said good faith effort. And I just said it sounds like an attitude problem based on the law. But
If they don't have to make a good faith effort or however, I'm not hung up on any particular wording. Senator Donnelly may have raised a good point there as far as the wording that we can take a look at. But, the philosophy that I'm looking at, the reason I chose to sponsor this bill is I think the rights of private property owners at a minimum ought to be that the government deal with them in good faith. And maybe it's just a selection of terminology that could be changed, and I'll be happy to look at, finding some language people could be more comfortable with. But still, the principle of the whole thing that, kind of irritates me a little bit. Senator?
Mr. Chairman, I agree with your philosophy. I think our philosophies are consistent. My fear exists in creating a new statutory test that the judiciary can interpret in ways that we would never intend it to be interpreted that way. And I think you're right on target. I think what your goals here, I agree with. I'm concerned with this language and somebody using this language to do something very different than what you're intending to do here.
Okay, it's obvious to me. And based on that discussion, we'll continue to take testimony on the bill today, but I think we need to probably hold on to it and see if we can't come up with some language that will actually do without having to create serious burdens of proof in the court or anything else that would prohibit government agencies from doing, work that's in the public's interest. So if it's a hang-up on the language, I'm sure we can try to work that out. Senator Phillips, do you have anything further?
Yes, Mr. Harris. Anybody else?
Yes.
Okay, I won't ask it.
Thank you, Mr. Harris.
You might later on give us other examples for the committee, other than just the airstrip. Is it airport or airstrip of Cape?
It's airport. It's in the airway. It's the airspace in this case.
Okay. Thank you. The next person to testify, Lisa. I'm not sure the spelling of the last name. Hey, could you state your name for the record and who you're affiliated with?
Good afternoon, Senator Mackey, members of the committee. My name is Lisa Blacker, and I'm affiliated with the Alaska Conservation Voice. We are an organization that represents the conservation concerns of 24 member groups statewide. We certainly commend the intent of this bill. We are all for private property rights. And for making the negotiations between private property owners and condemning authorities fair and equitable. We think that's wonderful. We wonder, however, how the term interests to be taken is defined. It's used three times in the bill. And it's not clear what that means. The way it's written is ambiguous, and we're wondering what that specifically means and what it refers to. It appears to us that the bill may establish a right of compensation, a new level of a right of compensation similar to proposed regulatory takings legislation. And if so, we don't think it's wise to open the door to the possibility of such financial liability to the state. Therefore, we recommend that you delete the lines relating to interest to be taken or otherwise define the term carefully so no ambiguity remains. That's about our level of concern.
Okay. Any questions? All right, thank you. We'll take that under consideration. Anyone else here to testify on this particular bill on 190 here in the public? Yes, sir.
Is DOT going to testify?
Yeah. John Jensen?
You?
Okay.
My name is John Jensen. I'm chief right-of-way agent for the Central Region, actually. Senator Phillips, how you doing?
Yeah. I mentioned your name in vain, eh?
No, you didn't. You did very good. At the moment, I'm on temporary assignment. I'm acting chief right-of-way agent for the Southeast region, so I have involvement in both regions and quite closely associated with the Northern region, too. So I'm kind of what you call the right-of-way group for all of the state here, and I don't really have any testimony. It's all very interesting to me to hear the testimony that's gone on before with a gentleman from Sea Alaska and listening to the comments. So really, I'm here to answer any questions you might have about the eminent domain process as it's been practically applied.
Okay. Senator Phillips.
You're a DOT, right?
Yes, I am. Right.
Work
closely with you and Dan Beardsley
on that project.
On our Highland Bridge project,
okay,
you bet.
Why is it? I'm just trying to get the bottom of this thing. And why is it? We have a law right now that's supposed to apply to everybody equally, supposedly, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. And in our situation, I know the situation we were involved was highly unusual, but it worked out fine. And now, why is that different? Is there a problem down here as far as attitudes concerned, or approaches, or view of the world? I'm asking because I don't know.
There may be the right-of-way staff, and I have not dealt with the gentleman from Sea Alaska or anyone there. I hope to make their acquaintance in the future and try to bridge any gaps that seem to be apparent here. There may be a problem, and I think it is accurate for what you say that it may be attitude. We all follow the same laws, and as far as I know and as far as I have ever done, we have always entered into good faith negotiations. I understand the frustration of a property owner, any property owner, that they feel that they're not fairly compensated. So those issues manifest themselves in this kind of frustration and bringing forth this kind of a request of the legislature. So I don't know. I don't know the answer to that exactly, Randy, other than we do make a good faith effort. However, our differences typically and usually in compensation lead to the frustrations that I understood him to say.
Senator Hoffman.
With the passage of this piece of legislation, do you think it would assist the finalization of the eminent domain process or deterrent?
Senator Hoffman, I have concerns about it, primarily reflecting what Senator Donnelly said, that it may delay the process, and if we have important public projects that need to be constructed and this is perceived somehow that we haven't followed the procedure, and I hope we do follow the procedure, then it may result in a delay and an interpretation by attorneys from the property owner in saying that we haven't followed what we are supposed to follow, and we do follow. The language in there is what we do, but it's the interpretation and the possible delay of a very important public works that concerns me, and the additional cost that might be associated with that. The testimony that I heard about the property owners facing the government is real for the small mom-and-pop kind of property owners. However, sophisticated property owners such as native corporations, I don't think, are intimidated by the process. In most of the cases where the property owner prevail and their estimate of just compensation is ultimately awarded, either by jury or pretrial settlement, those costs of their attorney's fees, expert witnesses, they're always reimbursed by the department, and so they really don't suffer any long-term monetary consequences. We pay a tremendous amount of money for making certain that the property owner is fairly compensated on all of our cases that have to go to litigation. But it's a tool that we really depend on in order to promote and develop our public projects. I wouldn't want to see that delayed. It's already complicated. But
John, I have no reason to believe that you don't deal with all the the instances that you've worked with in an upfront manner. I appreciate hearing that. It's good to hear that agencies are working in good faith with people, but I think you'd have to admit that's not always the case. And if it was always the case, we certainly wouldn't be hearing about it today. And my concern is, having only Sea Alaska to offer testimony today as one example, may not be the best example in terms of the effect on a smaller person or a private citizen that doesn't have those kind of resources or capabilities. If you believe under the people that work for you already follow a good faith effort, why would you why would you be afraid of any language that, and I've already established obviously here that maybe the wording that's in the particular bill needs to be finessed a little bit, but something in the nature of a good faith effort, why would you be afraid of doing that? I mean, having us expect you to make a good faith effort seems like a pretty small gesture. And I guess I don't subscribe to the notion that it will delay projects or anything else. I mean, a good faith effort could be made in a short amount of time. And sometimes, even if it does delay for a few weeks or a month or something like that, if you're protecting an individual's rights to their property that they may have worked all their life to secure, I think that's reasonable. I mean, we don't throw somebody in jail for life the day after they commit a crime. They are allowed due process, so maybe you could comment on that a little bit.
Senator Mackey, I agree with you, and my only reservation is the unknown, and that unknown being the same thing that Senator Donnelly testified to there, that it may be perceived by attorneys and others in the courts and judges and so forth that it's kind of a very subjective approach to the what we do here, and so how does that subjectivity manifest itself in our ability to move that project forward? And I don't know it until I've experienced that. To comment directly on the bill, I don't have any problem with the language on it. There's some housekeeping suggestions I might offer to you. I got them at my seat back there, but it is what we do, so therefore I can't object to what we already do. It's written as though we already do that, and we do that. It's just the interpretation by others that gives me just a pause and a concern.
And I definitely will take you up on that offer and be happy to work with you to try to find some language perhaps everybody can feel comfortable with. And it's not my interest to try to delay projects that are in the public interest. Certainly, in the case of Sea Alaska, the airport needed to be there, and it's a good public purpose. That's not their complaint. It's one over just compensation, whether they're a big corporation or a small private citizen. You know, there's certain rights that we need to protect, and I welcome your participation in finding that.
Thank you. I'm available for that.
Thank you very much, Senator Phillips.
Any consolations? You guys did an excellent job.
Thanks.
That was pretty sticky.
pretty innovative in some of those cases there.
Real sticky.
Thank you, John. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. Is there anyone else that would like to testify? I believe we have Jane Anvik on teleconference from DNR. Jane, do you have comments?
Chairman, we're available to comment on the next bill you're going to
get. This one affects that.
Okay.
By the way, it's not
mine. Thank you. Seeing no one else that would like to testify on this bill at this time, we'll hold this bill over and try to see if we can find a comfort level on the language and see what we can do there. The next bill, once again, Senator Phillips, I'd like to relinquish a chair and present this bill very briefly. It shouldn't take too long. Okay.
The next bill we have is Senate Bill 191. Change of state title of submerged lands. The sponsor is Senator Mackey. Senator Mackey, you have the floor.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This particular bill, Senate Bill 191, was introduced as a companion bill along with the other one to deal with some of these land issues. And this relates to exchanging state tide and submerged land to in order to protect municipal watershed, provide for airport, marine transportation facilities, and so on and so forth. I think the bill, essentially speaks for itself. What would happen is a municipality would, if they needed an area for a watershed to protect the community's water supply, if they needed it for a ferry terminal, if they needed it for an airport or a public facility, that DNR be given the option of exchanging submerged tide lands to the owner, the upland owner, in exchange there. And a good example is Mr. Harris is going to testify again on this particular bill from Sea Alaska, but there are a number of cases where large native corporations own land in and around municipalities and are subject to also having that land targeted for municipal and public purposes. There are other areas where they own land, where they have log transfer facilities, other types of uses on their land that they could exchange the watershed area, for example, for submerged tideland or things. And it's another option that would allow for DNR to have a little more flexibility to work with these private landowners to accomplish a public good. So that's the intent. This bill is approached in a very positive fashion, and so you know, you can consider that on its merits. That's about all I have at this point on that. I think we'd probably be better served to actually go into some testimony and hear from DNR.
Questions from the committee?
Let's see. Who do we have for Dave? Who do we have to testify? Okay, Mr. Harris, you're next again. At this point in time, I'll turn the gavel over to Chairman Mackey.
Okay, thank you, Senator Phillips.
I'll come back. You want to move this one too?
Yeah, I would like to move this one, and okay, we'll work on the other one.
If you need me, just have a
okay.
Move it. Please.
All right. Thank you, Dave. Okay, Mr. Harris.
Thank you, Senator. Again, for the record, I'm testifying to Senate Bill 191, Exchange of Lands for Public Purposes. My name is Rick Harris. I'm the Senior Vice President of Sea Alaska Corporation. Throughout Southeast Alaska, there's approximately 10% of the land in private ownership, but most of that land is disproportionately located in around the city's municipalities. And what we frequently find at these municipalities, lands needed by the municipalities for critical, essential municipal purposes. We specifically define those in the bill as municipal watersheds, airports, ferry terminals, are in private ownership. It's therefore, we think we need to create a new mechanism that would allow the state to acquire those essential municipal lands and at the same time allow the private landowner to receive some other value that would serve their purposes and needs. And what we propose in Senate Bill 91 is to create an efficient mechanism that we can acquire lands for municipal purposes, we can protect private land base, and then we also can reserve the tide and submerged lands for water-related uses. We think that the goals can be accomplished through the exchange of DNR-owned state-owned tide and submerged lands for privately owned lands that are needed for these essential municipal purposes. Under current law, DNR already is authorized to negotiate land exchanges. Unfortunately, these general statutes are quite discretionary, and there's no vehicle through which either a municipality or another state agency can compel DNR to commit state-owned lands to improve public purposes. We talked about the Cake Airport. That was actually a proposal that we said, we'll give you the airport land, trade us state land. The DOT says we don't own any land. It's all somebody else's. And so what we're trying to do here is say, let's create a mechanism where some of these DNR-owned lands are available where we can acquire them for these critical essential purposes. So what we see is the current land statutes are quite discretionary, and we think we need to find a better way to do it. Similarly, we think that the existing law lacks a clear statement of legislative priorities to guide DNR in the types of exchanges which the agency should focus. This bill creates an opportunity for that private, public-private land exchange, leaves the value of private land intact, and establishes priorities and compels DNR to commit some of its vast holdings for essential municipal purposes. We request your support of this legislation. We think that it will provide an excellent opportunity to resolve some of the issues that we deal with on a daily basis throughout the state. With that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Senator Phillips.
Give me another example here.
Yes, yeah. Senator.
Real life example.
I own, CLS Corporation owns municipal watersheds of Heidelberg,
right.
Has selection rights within the municipal watershed of Craig, owns a municipal watershed in Cake, and owns a municipal watershed in Huna.
Okay.
What we propose is that those are indeed the kinds of properties that should belong in private ownership. On three different occasions, we have attempted to find vehicles to create land exchanges that would allow us to move away from those watersheds and get them back into public ownership. In all cases, those efforts have been thwarted for a variety of reasons. We have sat back and said, what are things that we need? What do we think there are things that the state needs and the municipalities need? And we thought that this might be potentially a way to do it. Now, what would we trade for? Well, first of all, state tide and submerged lands have public trust interests. Okay, so what we're saying is that when we acquire those ownerships, We would take those lands where we need access to the uplands, to where our properties are. We're frequently on islands. We need the ability to get up and to access the uplands. So we're saying guaranteed perpetual access from the water to the uplands is extremely important to us, to the extent that we would be prepared to trade certain forest lands, as an example, for these watersheds. Now, we propose that this exchange be on an equal value basis. The second thing that we propose, and there's a series of comments, that the exchanges would not diminish the right of people to use the water. When we get this conveyance, we're not receiving title to the water. We're receiving the tide and the submerged lands. The water still is there, and these issues, those, of course, are all protected by the various environmental laws that exist. Second, our bill does not allow us to take tide or submerged lands in any critical areas, which would be designated through state classifications for non-compatible uses, such as sanctuaries, wildlife reserves, etc. So we're very careful about that. I think it's very important to understand that we looked at this very carefully, because the question is, we could start on a slippery slope here, and all of a sudden state tide and submerged lands would be traded to private interest for a variety of purposes. That's the reason that this bill was very specific to say they had to be for essential municipal purposes, and those purposes are very narrowly defined.
You guys have a
similar
thing like we have in Anchorage, the Heritage Land Bank, where you go to a pool and you start exchanging between private owners and the city. In this case, the municipality of Anchorage.
Unfortunately, in this circumstance, the way the land distribution process worked, most of the communities that I've described for you did not get any state land. They have no state land available to them, and so that just further compounds the problem. It would be great if they had land that we could say, okay, we'll get out of the watershed.
Do you understand what I'm saying with Anchorage?
We just don't have that option, and I think that in certain areas of the state the option exists, and in other areas it doesn't exist.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, thank you. Is there anyone else here locally that wish to testify on this bill? Andy? No, just here to listen? Okay. I know we have Jane Anvik online. Jane, are you still there? Okay, if you can go ahead and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, DNR has some significant concerns about the bill in general, and we are particularly concerned about the aspect of transferring tideland to private ownership. The state has a legal responsibility under the public trust doctrine to retain most tidelands and submerged lands. This is because DNR is required through the public trust doctrine to manage the shoreline lands for the use and enjoyment of all Alaskans. Most other states do not allow private individuals to acquire shorelands, and many that in the past did have spent millions of dollars to reacquire these public lands. While existing statutes allow DNR to transfer land tidelands to municipalities, the legislature specifically prohibited municipalities from selling these lands. In many cases that have been cited, such as Heidelberg, Craig, Cake, or Huna, the state of Alaska has, just as the previous witness had testified, has very little land, so that the possibility for land exchanges is very slim, simply because we don't have anything to exchange. The notion of public trust requires that the water, access to the water, water allocation, and marine activities are protected in perpetuity in order to provide for the common use of the land. If there is a concern that upland municipal uses, such as watersheds or such as expansion areas for airports, need to be protected, then and the proponents have suggested that tideland become some sort of a pool for compensation. DNR is willing to explore waiving lease fees, for example, in exchange for a community being able to municipal purposes. So while we are very supportive of providing some surety for municipal governments, particularly in Southeast Alaska, to controlling their watersheds, for example, we do not believe that conveying the tidelands is the methodology to pursue.
Okay, Jane, in terms of the 14C3 provision that you're talking about, that was with village corporations, right?
That's correct.
I mean, that doesn't affect a regional corporation such as Sea Alaska that has land in the watersheds in all those other communities.
Well, the 14C3 would be for the village corporations and the village lands and the municipal government, for sure. I'm not aware if Alaskan land is a subsurface estate of village holdings or are in fact fee title to the whole.
Well, my point is that 14C3 applies to village corporations, not regional, and the fact is that Sea Alaska Corporation physically owns the land in the watersheds of those other communities. Now, if you don't have any land to exchange and you're not able to do a land exchange with them, how are they supposed to be compensated or treated fairly in giving up those lands for a public purpose? I don't think anybody's opposed to giving the lands up for a public purpose. It's one of fair value or trade or compensation, and how do you deal with that?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know how to suggest that they should be compensated for having selected the watersheds or communities, but we don't have the 14C3 was really designed to try to provide land for public purposes. If the 14C3 selections were not able to accomplish that, then the community's only other choice would be to purchase the land from the private landowner.
And again, 14C3 does not apply to the regional corporation. So, you know, in this example that Mr. Harris offered us, that's not appropriate. And how many communities, especially small communities, can afford to go and buy a bunch of land from a private landowner? I guess it sounds to me like you don't have many options to deal with this issue, and that's the purpose of this bill, to give you an option. At least an option. You don't have to do it. It's just an option that you have available to you in cases that make sense for absolute public, public need for watersheds or ferry terminals or whatever, essential public services. It's another tool in your toolbox to be able to utilize to try to find a way to work it out.
Mr. Chairman, we're particularly concerned about the compulsory nature of the language in the bill, where, in fact, it isn't a discretionary tool, but it says if a community wants us to do it, we shall do it. And so the capacity of the Department of Natural Resources to be able to evaluate the public interest and the long-term interest of the state is removed by this legislation, and it is a mandatory requirement.
Okay. Any other questions from Jane? I guess I'd like to hear, do you have any other options as to how to deal with these kinds of situations? I mean, what do you suggest as a director of lands on how to deal with some of these private landowners that have lands that are needed by municipalities?
Disband the national forest. That'll take care of it.
Jane?
Mr. Chairman, I'm also accompanied by Dick Myers, and I'm going to encourage him to jump in if he has got some suggestions. But I think that I understand the difficulties associated with community development, in particular Southeast Alaska, where the vast majority of the land are owned by the federal government. But I don't have alternative ways of compensating a private landowner if what they own is the watershed. In conversation with the persons who had been legislation that could consider waiving the fee structure for leases if the landowner was willing to ensure the continuation of the watershed for the community. But the conveying of tidelands is a very difficult proposition for the Department of Natural Resources to consider, because that's where the public trust rests.
Well, yeah, I realize that, but when you talk about reasonable alternatives and circumstances that arise, I mean, if somebody owns the uplands, which is private property, and they have a log transfer facility, for example, to put in, you know, what if they're going to have a log transfer facility there, why shouldn't they be allowed to own it in exchange for another valuable municipal purpose that was needed? You know, providing that people's access to the water and other things are not affected. I mean, you stated one of your objections was you have to protect the water for the public trust. Well, this doesn't affect the water.
Mr. Chairman, this is Dick Miley. And I guess some of our concerns are that even if we transfer title, then it's no longer land managed by the department. And even though they may currently have a log transfer facility there, and they may currently allow public use or access through there, once it's their land, they can change that in the future. We transfer title to them, and it's no longer subject to the public trust doctrine. And in other states, the courts have actually made go back and reacquire public trust lands that they've given away, where the public has lost access to the shoreline. These U.S. Supreme Court decisions on that very issue that have upheld the requirements for states to go back in and reacquire those lands, because we have a responsibility under the public trust doctrine to guarantee that the public has a right to use those lands, and we can't carry out that guarantee if they're in private ownership. And I might also add on the CAKE issue, we've talked in the past to the CAKE Tribal Corporation about options there, and we had encouraged them to try to work with the Forest Service on an exchange, because, as you all know, the Forest Service owns most of the land around there. And the only reason why the State Department of Natural Resources didn't pursue an exchange there was, well, there were two reasons. One was there was no state land to trade. And the other thing is that even though, I think in the statement here it says that eminent domain is a costly and time-consuming way, and this is viewed as an alternative to that. Well, land exchanges are also very time-consuming, costly, and have had an incredibly poor success rate in the state of Alaska. And it's not a simple solution to say we're just going to exchange the lands and get them out of the watershed.
Okay. Well, yeah, I guess we disagree to disagree, which is fine. But I think if somebody's going to take somebody's land for a watershed, obviously you said... you know, land exchanges have not been very successful in the past, and I thought I heard Jane say that they don't have a lot of tools in their toolbox. Well, this is certainly an alternative for you to look at to try to resolve some of these. I certainly understand what your concerns are, and obviously we'll have a chance to talk more about it. Did you have anything else from Anchorage at this point?
No, sir. We'll be available for questions, though.
Okay, thank you, Janet, for being on today, and Dick, I'm sure we'll hear more from you as this bill moves along. Anyone else here locally in Juneau that wanted to testify? Yes, John.
Thank you. My name is John Jensen. Again, I testified on 190 there, or answered questions. This is a bill here that primarily deals with the Department of Natural Resources. However, Mr. Milek of the Department of Natural Resources commented, and I had a concern about the eminent domain proceedings being costly and prolonged. And actually, that I believe that that's quite the opposite. The eminent domain proceedings are a tool that we use that provides the least cost to the public anyway. And it's also most often the most expedient way to acquire lands rather than a prolonged negotiation over exchanges. The other point of confusion that I have here is that the language of the bill itself refers...
Where are you looking at?
I'm looking here specifically at paragraph 1,
under, of course, Section 38, this is page 2,
okay.
Under the titles 38050405, parent 1.
Line 22?
Yes,
dealing
correct.
The
governing body of a municipality determines that a privately owned land is needed for the protected watershed of the municipality or for construction or expansion of an airport or marine transportation facility. While a municipality may undertake the construction of a or expansion of an airport or marine transportation facility, it's most often accomplished by the state of Alaska. And I'm wondering if this bill, which is Title 38, is the DNR bill, if this would apply to state-owned land or state-sponsored construction or expansion facilities, when most of those airports and marine transportations are, of course, state-sponsored and federally funded. So I'm a little confused as to where this might fit in here and what it really means.
Okay, I think what that's dealing with was how the thing comes about, and that it would take a municipality first initiating the action and initiating the request to DNR to exchange these lands because the municipality has determined that use is in the public interest and the public need for whatever it is. If the public needs an airport, obviously that's handled through DOT. If they need a ferry terminal, the same kind of a thing. If it's a watershed, then, you know, I actually would think DOT would like this because since DOT doesn't have any land to exchange, when you need an airport or a ferry terminal or something, this gives DNR a tool to be able to help accomplish that. And the reason it's written to do with the municipality is just not so you have a private landowner that says, okay, you know, we have this land and we'll give it to you, but we want this submerged tide land. It would first need to be come from a municipality that would look at the overall economic interests and public interest that's needed by that municipality, and then the municipality would initiate that discussion with DNR. So it's a way to keep the public in the public hearing process and certainly the local needs, you know, at arm's length and have them have the ability to initiate this kind of a process. So it's kind of a partnership. In most cases, it involves a partnership with the state and with a private landowner and with the municipality to ever get anything done. And it's, as you stated yourself before, it's real hard for DOT to get into any kind of land transfer or any kind of exchange discussions because you simply don't have that in your bailiwick. So, you know, hopefully that answers your question, but hopefully it's a positive step to have agencies and municipalities be able to work closely together to, again, I remember what the whole thing is about is when a municipality needs a watershed or a ferry terminal or something like that, something in the public interest. This is not a situation where a private landowner says, I don't like the value of the trees that are on this particular piece of land. I want to give it back for something more valuable. This is initiated by a municipality. And, you know, municipal leaders around the state have as much frustration as private landowners, I think, sometimes. So that's where that's coming from.
Okay, I appreciate that. I just, and maybe that helps clarify, for those projects that we undertake, whether it be an airport or a marine transportation facility, we would enter into the purchase of that for that particular project, and not necessarily involved, of course, the municipality or the Department of Natural Resources. To have those third parties enter would, I fear, would complicate the situation. Although it is an option, and it's a very good option, it may complicate and slow down that particular development of that public project. So it was just an observation I had.
Sure.
For whatever.
And I certainly welcome your input on it as well, and for raising that particular issue. But could you see this as something positive, actually, where DOT doesn't have to actually come up with the cash to go buy some land, that by working with the municipality and DNR that they exchange some tide lands, which are adjacent to an upland ownership, which is all private anyway. Essentially, there's not a lot of public access there if it's private land to begin with. But couldn't you see where DOT would not have to come up with some money if there was a reasonable site that could be exchanged for, instead of having to come up, I mean, if you look at it simply from a fiscal standpoint.
Senator Mackey, I do believe that it may be appropriate in some instances. However, I have to agree with Ms. Anvik that if the agency developing the particular project is required to do that, and so it becomes the only option, and the other options through good faith negotiations for the purchase for exchange of compensation rather than other land. If that's precluded, then it becomes somewhat of an obstacle to development of that particular project. So as long as it's a voluntary option, and voluntary, I'm suggesting that it be voluntary between the parties and not obligated by either one. If we could do that as an
so you think there should be some good faith discussion and good faith negotiation there?
Yes, we always do. Yes,
I want to thank you for making the same argument I made on the last bill. Whereas you would like to have a good opportunity for good faith negotiation, yes. Other people would like to have the same opportunity when you're taking their land. Yeah. So yeah, that's good. I'm glad we came around on that one.
Sure. I don't think I did yet. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. And I look forward to if you could provide me with any written analysis that you have or suggestions how to make it better, I'd be more than happy to look at that.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Yeah. Okay. That was the last one we had signed up to testify. Ma'am, did you wish to testify? I know we had written testimony from your group that we've distributed to committee. If you want to go ahead and testify, we'll...
Thank you for this opportunity to testify once again. My name is Lisa Blacker, and I'm staff member of the Alaska Conservation Voice.
Go ahead.
And I'm testifying on behalf of Kay Brown, who's our executive director in Anchorage, who is unable to testify today. The Alaska Conservation Voice supports the protections in current law that ensure public access to navigable and public waters of the state. We're concerned that the proposed changes in Senate Bill 191 will weaken those protections by allowing state-tied and submerged lands to become privately owned through land exchanges. One of our concerns is that it's a very slippery slope to start exempting people, organizations, or facilities such as the log transfer facilities from the public trust. We're worried because what if a private owner does not follow through with a proposal to use tied or submerged land in a manner that will promote maritime commerce or navigation? What happens, for example, if a private owner goes out of business, decides to sell, dies, anything like that? What happens to that land? We feel that that should be clarified in the legislation. Once these lands are in private ownerships, what mechanisms will be available to ensure public access also in perpetuity? So to sum it, our concerns are with public access because right now Alaska does have public access to all of these state-tied and submerged lands, and also that what happens to this private land if it gets sold or ends up being turned over to someone else, what safeguards are going to be installed for that. At the very least, we would like the bill to limit the transfer of state-tied and submerged land within municipal boundaries so as to not open up the entire state for that type of transfer opportunity.
Okay. Thank you. I also would like to, request that if you've got that specific change that you'd like to see or whatever, you feel free to submit that to me and we'll be happy to look at it.
Okay, I just added one other thing,
okay.
And I will do
and
that.
Your,
thank
your
you.
Written testimony was entered in the record, and it has been made available to everyone as well.
Great, thank you
okay.
very much.
Thank you. Anyone else here to testify? Committee will stand at ease briefly. Get Senator Phillips or Senator Donnelly. Okay, committee will back on record. In terms of Senate Bill 191. It's my intention to want to move the bill to the Resources Committee. This time, if we can have a motion. Senator Donnelly.
Move the bill with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
Is there objection? Hearing none, bill's moved from committee. And we don't have anything further to come before the committee, so we'll be adjourned.